Welcome to the Woodridge Baptist Church Podcast. For more information about what's happening in the life of our church, visit our website at www.woodridge.org. Enjoy the podcast.
We are in Hebrews chapter 2, so I invite you to turn there. We're really going to be focusing on verses 1 through 18 this morning. There's a reason that we showed the clip that we did before the sermon, and it's kind of going to the theme that you see in the first four or five verses of chapter 2 of Hebrews, and it's the problem of spiritual drift. This week, I was looking in the news, and there's a guy named Joshua Harris. And years ago, when I was a college pastor, Joshua Harris made kind of a big splash because he wrote a book called I Kiss Dating Goodbye. Some of you might have heard of that book. It was enormously influential. And at the time, when I was a college pastor, they were saying, well, you know, what do you think of this book? And I was like, well, I don't know. I haven't read it. And that was largely because I was a seminary student. I was having to read all the books that they were assigning to me, if you know what I'm talking about. So I broke away from it on a weekend, and I went and read the book. And I came back, and I did a series for my college students called I Kissed My Date Goodbye. And it kind of let them know what I thought about the book over a couple of weeks. Here was the thing, though. Just this last week, Josh Harris has made a public statement that he has walked away from the faith. And the other thing that he indicated was that he and his wife were separating and probably they were going to be getting a divorce. And that was just one of those things that after hearing it, it broke my heart. I don't know about you, but it broke my heart. The good news is that I felt that, you know, in spite of the fact that this is what he's going through publicly, he's expressing this publicly, Jesus is not done with him. And so I'm praying that in the coming days, what he finds is this renewed sense of commitment and fervor and excitement for what he once had in Jesus. Probably a lot of you would say there's been those times where in my own spiritual life and walk, I feel the same way as Joshua Harris. That I'm just totally content to say, I'm kind of fed up with this. Now, I'm not going to ask you to show your hands, but maybe a lot of you sitting out there can say, yeah, that's been me. And maybe there are a number of factors that are involved as to why you feel that way. Here's what I want you to see this morning, is that means that you, along with a lot of other Christians before you, have something common in your experience, where you just get to a place where you say, I'm ready to just kind of throw my hands up. And that's what I want to say before we begin looking at the text. So let's just jump in and see what the Lord wants to teach us today. Here's the way it begins. It says, for this reason, we must pay attention all the more to what we have heard, so that we will not drift away. For if the message spoken through angels was legally binding and every transgression and disobedience received a just punishment, how will we escape if we neglect such a great salvation? This salvation had its beginning when it was spoken of by the Lord, and it was confirmed to us by those who heard him. At the same time, God also testified by signs and wonders, various miracles, and distributions of gifts from the Holy Spirit according to his will. This is a good way to start, because one of the things that we see is in spite of the fact that what we've done is we've walked away, God has continued to still speak. And it's not just one way that God has continued to speak. There are multiple ways that God has continued to speak. One of the reasons is we're cut differently. You and I may not be the same. The way that we connect to God might be a little bit different. But you see here a number of ways that God has continued to speak. It was spoken of by the Lord himself. You know, Jesus, if you look in John's gospel, he says, there's going to be one thing that I leave that's going to be a testament to all of the things that I said that would prove that it's true, all the miracles that have been performed to this date that show that they are true, and it's that I'm going to rise from the dead. There's one thing that proves it all. That's it. So the Lord speaks, but also confirmed by others that have heard it. Can you think of people that when you have struggled, have been willing to walk alongside you? You can be honest with them and say, I'm struggling. There was no facade. You could just put the cards on the table. And what you knew is that you weren't going to find judgment there because they know that they've struggled too. Instead, you're going to find a person that, what, like Moses, when his arms start to sink and they're like, get his arms up. And people are going to hold the arms up. Or if you look at James, when it's talking about a persecuted group of Christians, we don't know who they are. We just know that they're persecuted. And it says, and they would come and support one another. And even when they were so exhausted from their circumstances, the others were praying for them when they had no more words that they even knew how to pray. That should be a sign to the world on what the church of Jesus should look like and how the church of Jesus should function. But it's real. A lot of ways that God speaks, signs and wonders. Miracles. But I also want to be quick to point out, just because God performs a miracle doesn't mean that you would believe in God. Doesn't mean it. There are plenty of times in Scripture where God does something pretty amazing and people respond to it with, I don't think so. I don't think so. In our heart, part of what it is that we think is, if God just gave me something else, then I would believe. Because the problem isn't me. The problem is in the messenger or the message that's been given. And what you find in the first couple of verses of Hebrews is, I've been talking in a lot of ways so that you would know that I'm here for you. So why do we drift? I mean, if the beginning of this is, hey, pay attention all the more to what we've heard so that we don't drift away, I think what we realize is, just like the people here, they struggled with drift. How many of you would say, I've struggled with drifting as well? I was reading a story this week, and there was a lady that went out to the beach, and she gets into a raft, and as she was in the raft, she fell asleep. Thought that was awesome. But when she actually comes to, she's like a long way off from where she thought that she would be. She's like, I'm in trouble. The reason that we drift is usually one of two things. One is that we're actually rowing in the direction that we're going, and it takes us to a place that we don't want to go. The other is that we've put the oars down and we're not rowing at all. We just let things carry us away. Two different ways of drifting often has the exact same effect. We wind up in a place that we shouldn't be. So why do we drift? Let me give you a couple of things to think about this morning. Here's one. We have an out-of-control schedule. We have an out-of-control schedule. So basically, we are so busy, maybe even doing good things, that we're willing to pass over better things. So I'm not even here trying to judge the things that you're doing. I'm just saying, in a scale of life commitments, maybe we have an out-of-control schedule. Ephesians 5:16 gives us this warning. It says, you know, redeem the time because the days are evil. Redeem the time. Here's what that means. That means if we want the church to have the impact in the world, or for that matter, just in the community that we're in, that means that we have to make the choices as to how we're going to be using our time. Paul commissions the church at Ephesus, and he says, redeem it. He doesn't just say, make sure that you're busy. He says, redeem your time. So here's what that means. You could take a look at just the people that are in your circle of influence. You see the pain and the hardship that is there, and you say, today I'm going to make an active choice to redeem the time. This is a person that needs a blessing, and what it is God has blessed me to be a blessing for them. That's redeeming the time. Parents, you redeem your time when you see that your children are going in a direction that isn't going to be, well, it's not going to be Christ honoring. It is not going to be a blessing to their life, and you're willing to love them enough to speak truth into their life and into their heart and be a living example for them. That is redeeming the time. We have those choices to make. The question is, are we too busy to do it? Redeem the time. We also see this in Psalm chapter 90, verse 12. And the reason I even bring this up is because when it says, teach us to number our days that we may apply our hearts to wisdom, teach us to number our days. You wake up in the morning and you say, this day is consecrated for an end or a purpose. The school year is not that far away, teachers. The school year is not that far away, teachers. By the way, we're already praying for you, right? But you realize that you might have a chance to put some math into somebody's mind. You also have a chance to put a living witness into somebody's heart. You have enormous opportunities. But when you wake up, if you're not realizing what Psalm 90:12 is saying, which this is a day that wasn't owed to you, but instead God gave it to you, the day becomes much more precious. Instead, many of us just wake up and we just assume the day. It's like we were entitled to it. And Psalm 90 is saying, be very careful with that way of thinking, because then you just make an assumption with the way that you're going to live it. Instead, teach us to number our days that we may apply our hearts to wisdom. It's not just saying that we get wisdom, it's that we apply our life to the wisdom that we possess. We do something with it. And that's how you become a living witness to Jesus. But here's the thing, it won't happen if your schedule is out of control. It won't happen. It's even been said of people in ministry that they are so busy doing the little things of the church in the day-to-day that they lose the ministry that God has portioned for them. That can be the story of all of us if our schedule is out of control. Here's another reason that we drift is discouragement. You're just discouraged. You feel beat down. You're just tired. for the people to whom this letter was written, and we're not exactly sure who they are. We are sure that they have a Jewish background, because you're going to see as we go through Hebrews, a lot of stuff about the Old Testament is going to come up. But one of the reasons that people get discouraged, please pay attention to what I'm trying to tell you, is because of Christians. I visited with a person, this was a couple of months ago, and they said, I got to say, I'm just struggling. I'm struggling. And I said, well, why are you struggling? And they said, because of Christians. I'm sick of the unwillingness for them to just be real about their life, the struggles they have, the beauty of the Holy Spirit to overcome them. Instead, we got to make sure that we have this facade up. He said, that's not the church. And so when I go to church and I'm struggling, it's not a place that I can be honest. I don't have anybody walking through things with me. I don't have anybody praying over me. It's just like church is getting together and just kind of doing whatever the church does. He said, I'm fed up. He said, what's worse is when I was going into the church, you know, they were judging me for being a person that was struggling. When I'm sitting there going, everybody in there is struggling. It's not a question of are we, it's what is our struggle. But I love what he said. He said, I have yet to be enticed to walk away from Jesus. I'm just struggling with the church. Has that been you? For some, we're discouraged because of our life circumstances. Your life is not what you thought it would be, and you struggle. Or maybe what you thought is that there was this expectation of that what God was going to do for you, and God has let you down. For them, it could have been because they were persecuted, and they're struggling. But discouragement. Here's a third. The third reason that we drift is we have misplaced affections. Over the years, I've had the opportunity to partner with a lot of counselors, and especially those that specialize in marriage and family counseling. And I was talking with somebody a couple of weeks ago, and I said, okay, so you've got 20 years of counseling experience. You specialize in marriage and family counseling. Let me ask you a question. What is the main thing that you see that causes a husband and a wife basically to go separate ways? And the answer was, well, it's not necessarily always just this one decision where they wake up in the morning and they go, you know, I don't want to be married to you today. It was a series of small decisions that took their affections to a different place. So instead of enjoying life together, they started enjoying life apart. Instead of making a mutual investment in one another, they started investing in other relationships. And on the front end, it usually kind of has this appearance of being harmless, right? Because it's just fun. And then in the end, what you find is he's over there, she's over there. They don't know who they are with each other anymore because they're not with each other anymore. He said, that's usually the common story, misplaced affections. Let me suggest to you this. It's no different in a marriage than it is in your relationship with Jesus. Where you're placing your affections is going to tell me the health of your relationship with Jesus. And we even have this warning in 1 John chapter 2, verse 15, where it says, do not love the world or the things of the world. I want to be clear. You go back to Genesis, God creates, and he says, enjoy what I've created. Yes. Enjoy what God has created, but don't love the things of the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. And what is that saying? When you talk about when you really love something, you throw your whole self at it. And the only one we're supposed to be throwing our whole self at is Jesus. That's it. Enjoy the world. Throw yourself at Jesus. Fourth thing, why we drift. This one's rather obvious. Sin. When people have looked at the Joshua Harris story, and again, I am not beating up on this guy. I've prayed for him this week. I've prayed for him. He was pastoring a church. He's out. Doesn't even describe himself as a Christian anymore. I'm praying for him. But this is what sin will do. The first thing that we saw was his marriage, his relationship with his wife starts to break apart. And then once his relationship with his wife starts to break apart, now all of a sudden I'm starting to struggle with some things of my faith. This is, by the way, the normal story. The reason that we really struggle with our relationship with Jesus is because we're making decisions that, quite honestly, aren't compatible with a relationship with Jesus, and we feel like we have a choice that we have to make. Well, all the worse for Jesus. I'm just going to keep this way of life. That's one of the things that sin does. Here's another thing that sin will do, and we see it in Hebrews 12:1. It says, Therefore, we also, since we're surrounded by a great cloud of witnesses. And he says, let's lay aside every weight, drop the weights and the sin which so easily ensnares us. And it does. And let us run with endurance the race that is set before us. When I was a long distance runner, I used to put 5-pound weights around each of my ankles when I was training, right? Now come race time, I wasn't going to be doing that. But the whole point was that there was something positive in the resistance and the way that it trained up my body to run. Here's the thing. Here it's saying you need to lay down the weights that are keeping you from running freely in Jesus. What are the weights that are around your ankles that are keeping you from running freely with Jesus? See, many people begin to drift away from God because they have sin in their life, but it causes them to feel guilt when they should be at church. And here's the thing. They feel reluctant to pray or read their Bible when they know that they have these issues in their lives because they feel the shame related to the choices that they're making. And they go, I can't go to the church until I start to get things right. How about this? Go to the church so that you can start getting things right. It's exactly the opposite way that we should be thinking. But this is what sin does. It makes us feel that the church is a place that we don't belong. Here's the way I look at church. Church is a place where we should go and to put the sin that's like an addiction on the table so that it's beat, so that it's whipped, so that it's overcome, and it doesn't, as Hebrews says, ensnare you anymore and hold you back from what Jesus wants you to be in Him. That's what the church should be. But that's how we typically react. I can't go there until I get my stuff together. How about go there and get your stuff together? By God's grace, right? But go and get it together. So here's the way the rest of this chapter goes on. You see the struggle. We struggle with drift. We find ourselves, we're like the lady in the raft. We just kind of went to sleep and we wake up and we go, oh my gosh, I'm a pretty good chunk away from the land. And this is a problem. But here's the way that it goes on. For he has not subjected to angels the world to come that we're talking about. But someone somewhere, by the way, I think that's a little bit of an interesting way to communicate. Somewhere and somewhere said something. But someone somewhere has testified, and by the way, basically quoting Psalm 8 directly. What is man that you remember him, or the son of man that you care for him? You made him little lower than the angels for a short time. You crowned him with glory and honor and subjected everything under his feet. All right, that's a little bit of a weird kind of couple of verses there. But when you think about it, the angels, you feel like they're a higher order. And it's like, maybe, but it's for a short time. You know, we're created in human form by God. Angels, they're a different kind of person. They're angelic persons. And you go, they're higher than us. They're more powerful than us. And the whole narrative here is to say, not just for a little bit. Let me ask you a question. When it says we're made a little lower than the angels for a short time, Aristotle taught Alexander the Great. Alexander the Great was the son of King Philip of Macedon. So let me ask you a question. Who was greater? For a bit, it seems that Aristotle was certainly greater than Alexander the Great, because Alexander the Great, in spite of his place, in spite of his position, you get it? Was put under Aristotle to be the one to train him and to lead him in the way of life. So who was greater? Well, for a short time, it certainly seems to be Aristotle, but for a while. And it's absolutely no different with us. But for a while, but for a short time, they're going to be greater. But there's going to come another time. As the text goes on, in subjecting everything to him, he left nothing that is not subject to him. And as it is, we do not yet see everything subjected to him. And you're looking at your world and going, well, that's a fact. We certainly don't see everything subjected to Jesus, do we? I was looking this week at the police reports, because as I was reading this verse, I was like, I'm just going to go to the police. And so I started looking at Northeast Houston, because that's where we're at. And I only picked one month, which was the month of December of the year 2017, if you want to be specific. And I read every single police report. And these are just the ones we know of, right? These aren't the ones that got away. These are the ones we know of. And in one month, in an area not far from where you live, there were well between 250 to 300 police reports that went in that ranged from burglary to assault to rape. And that was right here. That was right here. And I'm sitting there going, yeah, it kind of goes to prove the verse, doesn't it? in subjecting everything to him, but we don't see everything subjected to Jesus. It's just not there yet. And so that what that means is we live kind of in the middle of this promise. We live in the way that the world is going to be when he comes back and he restores it. And we live as people that are supposed to be committed to him, to making the difference so that the world isn't as broken as it is. But it's not totally subjected to him yet. But here's what it says in verse 9. But we do see Jesus made lower than the angels for a short time. Why does it say that? It's because he takes on a human form, so that by God's grace, he might taste death for everyone. Notice it says he might taste it. He might. And you go, what does that even mean? And the answer is, for those that have accepted him, the death that we face is defeated. It's whipped. He's got it. So that by God's grace, he might taste death for everyone, crowned with glory and honor because he suffered death. For in bringing many sons and daughters to glory, it was entirely appropriate that God, for whom and through whom all things exist, should make the source of their salvation perfect through suffering. We suffer, he suffered, and we become something in the process. This is what Romans 5 even says. It cultivates us when we suffer. For the one who sanctifies and those who are sanctified all have one Father. That is why Jesus is not ashamed to call them brothers and sisters. Maybe underline that part for you this morning. Saying this, I will proclaim your name to my brothers and sisters. I will sing hymns to you in the congregation. Again, I will trust in him. And again, here I am with the children that God gave me. And now since the children have flesh and blood in common, Jesus also shared in these so that through his death, he might destroy the one holding the power of death. That is the devil. He's going to get whipped and free those who were held in slavery all their lives by the fear of death. For it is clear that he does not reach out to help angels, but to help Abraham's offspring. The salvation, basically, that you see in Jesus' death is not for the angels that left God in glory. It is for those of us who have fallen and make the choice whether or not we're going to follow him again. Therefore, he had to be like his brothers and sisters in every way. This is Jesus, so that he could become a merciful and faithful high priest in matters pertaining to God, to make atonement for the sins of the people. For since he himself has suffered when he was tempted, he's able to help those who are tempted. This is what I want you to see this morning. I want you to see the real Jesus. That's what I want you to see. Jesus, and this is what you see in these last few verses, he gets dirty with you. He gets dirty with you. If you look at Hebrews 2:9, that's what it says. And what we learn from it is Jesus comes knowing that there is a cost to him, when frankly we're usually willing to shrink away at the possibility of something costing us. And he just comes in. Some years ago, one of my favorite professors, Scott Austin, who's passed away, he's gone on to be with the Lord. I remember having a conversation with him. Graduate of University of Texas. Any Longhorns out there this morning? There's a few. But I remember sitting down with Scott. Scott was a peculiar guy. He always had instant coffee in his pocket here, and I don't mean like a little bit. I mean the whole jar was always in his pocket. You know, and I was like, well, that's different. He always looked disheveled. You know, Scott always looked like he had never taken a bath. Actually, brilliant guy. And I remember talking. We're walking across the campus at A&M, and I said, God, he would go to All Faith Chapel there at A&M, and he would pray multiple times a day. And we're walking across the campus, and I said, Scott, you know, you're a really bright guy. And I didn't know where he was spiritually. And I said, you know, what do you believe about God? Department of Philosophy, so you ask these questions, right? What do you believe about God? Who do you think God is? And he said, oh, I'm a Christian. I said, oh, that's interesting. I said, so what is it that made you choose Christianity versus, you know, something else? And he said, because it's the only time that God saw fit to get dirty with me. That's it. Knowing who I am and saying I'm going to meet him where he's at. And I said, that's for me. That's for me. Folks, that's for you too. It is no different for Scott Austin than it is for you. So a couple of years ago when Scott was unfortunately found dead, I was like, he is experiencing a quality of life that I've yet to experience. Praise God for that. He gets dirty with you in order to save you. And that's the second point. In order to save you. You see this in Hebrews chapter 2, verse 10. And you see it in Hebrews chapter 2, verses 14 and 15. Where it says, for in bringing many sons and daughters to glory, it was entirely appropriate that God, for whom and through whom all things exist, should make the source of their salvation perfect through suffering. And then if you look at verses 14 and 15, and now since the children have flesh and blood in common, Jesus also shared in these so that through his death he might destroy the one holding the power of death, the devil, and free those who were held in slavery all their lives by the fear of death. Why did he come? It's so you don't have to sit there and be enslaved to that. There's freedom in him. So he gets dirty with us in order to save us. Verse 10, it literally is saying he is the champion of salvation. In the ancient Near East, by the way, with the time of Jesus, they often selected someone to represent them in a fight. There's a fight going on. We're going to select a champion. You've probably already seen this in the Bible. Do you remember David and Goliath? We're going to select a champion. The champion goes out in front of us, and the champion fights for us. It's the same image that you see here in Jesus that you would see in somebody like David. He goes out. He whips the giant. Right. Jesus goes out. He whips the giant. You go, who's the giant? And the answer is, it's your death. And he whips it. He whips it. Matthew McCullough, I love what he has to say. If death is not a problem, and frankly, for some of us, we don't treat it like it's a problem. But if death is not a problem, Jesus won't be much of a solution. The more deeply we feel death's sting, the more consciously we will feel the gospel's healing power. The more carefully we number our days, the more joyfully we'll hear that death's days are numbered too. Did you hear that? Let me share it again. The more deeply we feel death's sting, the more consciously we will feel the gospel's healing power. The more carefully we number our days, the more joyfully we'll hear that death's days are numbered too. But then it goes on to say this. If death tells us we're not too important to die, the gospel tells us we're so important that Christ died for us. And not because death's message about us is wrong, it isn't on our own. We're dispensable. But joined to Jesus through our connection to him, we are children of God, and God will not let us die any more than he left Jesus in the grave. That won't happen. So he came and he got dirty with us so that he could save us. Because, and this is third, because he loves us, he is not ashamed of us. Did you see the theme there? He loves you, he is not ashamed of you. I've shared from Brené Brown before. Brené Brown is a professor at the University of Houston. Here's your chance, Cougar fans. Are you out there? There you go. There were two. Brené Brown gave a TED Talk and has been viewed millions and millions and millions and millions of times. Cougar fans, are you happier now? She writes a lot about guilt and shame. She has a lot of great insights. But here's what she said, and I just want to share it with you. She said, I believe that there's a profound difference between shame and guilt. I do too, by the way. She said, I believe that guilt is adaptive and helpful. It's holding something we've done or failed to do up against our values. And as a result, we feel psychological discomfort. We know that we're not where we ought to be. She said this, though. I define shame as the intensely painful feeling or experience of believing that we are flawed and therefore unworthy of love and belonging. Something we've experienced, something we've done or failed to do, makes us unworthy of that connection. There's a huge difference between guilt and shame. She goes on to say that shame needs three things to grow. It needs secrecy. I hold it to myself. Through silence, I'll never speak of it. And judgment. I'm just constantly going to condemn myself because of it. Shame cannot survive being spoken, though, she says. It cannot survive empathy, where others are literally identifying with you in what you're undergoing, the experiences that you've had, the failures that are a part of your story. But she goes on to say this, share with people who have earned the right to hear your story. Share with them your story. And here's why. It's because the difference between shame and guilt is the difference between I am bad and I did something bad. We have to remember this morning that every single one of us have been created in the image of God. There's nothing that sin can do to destroy the fact that we're created in the image of God. Nevertheless, what we have to do is to deal with the sin problem. What is in me and the effects around me? What is in you and the effects around you? Jesus is saying this, I've taken your guilt and you weren't meant for shame. I've taken your guilt and you weren't meant for shame. Did you remember what she said? Shame is this intensely painful feeling or experience of believing that we're flawed and therefore unworthy of love and affection, unworthy of belonging. And this is exactly what sin does. It makes us look at Jesus and say, I'm unworthy of belonging. And in a sense, that is true. He is saying this, no, I love you, recognizing your story, so come on. Come on. And that's what brings up the fourth point. Jesus can really help us. He can really help us. He gets it. Do you remember the part? He's a high priest, tempted as we are tempted, but did not sin. He gets it. So this is the question. I mean, why did his suffering help him help us? And I think his temptation, I think his suffering connects us to him in a few ways. But this is a short list, all right? But here's some things to think about. Jesus gets the draw of temptation. He totally gets it. He was here and he gets it. Tired, hungry, thirsty, he's been there. Sad, not always understanding what the Father's up to, he's been there. Betrayed and rejected, you can check the box. Stabbed in the back by friends, absolutely. He knows what it's like when people treat him like a hack, when what he's trying to do is righteous. We see this in Matthew 23, 37. Jesus, who has gone and basically trying to take religious people and say, what you're doing is hurting people, it's not helping. And he says, Jerusalem, who kills the prophets, stones those who are sent to her. How often I've wanted to gather your children together as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, but you're not willing. He's up there literally killing himself so that can find the right way of life. And how they treat him? Treat him like a hack. Treat him like he doesn't know what he's talking about. And they say there's another way, but it isn't his way. He gets it. He's willing to endure the right path, even though many aren't even going to follow him. He gets it. Bottom line, Jesus gets it. And sometimes it just makes a difference when you know that somebody's been there and they get it. He gets it. So I want you to remember Brené Brown, just for a moment. Share with someone who has earned the right to hear your story. I want you to think of Jesus on the cross. I want you to see Jesus on the cross. I want you to see an empty tomb, but I want you to see him on the cross. He has earned the right to hear your story. For all the brokenness that you've endured from choices of others, for all of the brokenness that you've experienced because of your own choices, he's deserving of you sharing your story with him. The way that the Gospels describe it, Jesus came to seek and save the lost. That's all of us. But to offer us something better. And that's what we all need. The only question this morning, it isn't, what is Jesus offering? It's, are you going to accept it? That's really it. And so I want to spend just a moment in prayer together. You know, maybe this morning, it's time. You know, some of you may have come in this morning because you are hurt. I hope what you see in Jesus is that he gets it. He gets it. But what we have to do this morning is also just take seriously what it is that we're coming to grips with. We're coming to grips not just with the fact that we're enticed towards sin, but we just choose it, and there's a better way. The better way is choosing Jesus. And so I want to leave just a little bit of what we're doing this morning to this possibility. Maybe you came in here today, you've never made the choice. You've never made the choice to follow Jesus. I want to invite you to make that decision this morning. I don't think that you're here by accident. I think that you're here by God's hand. And so I'm going to lead you in a time of prayer in just a minute. But for others, you come in here and you say, I made that decision to follow Jesus years ago. And that's good. We celebrate that. That's the good stuff of life. But you feel a lot the way that these people in this part of the letter to Hebrews feels. And you feel beat and whipped and beaten down. What I hope you find is encouragement and refreshing and renewal in Jesus and in this church. In this church. What I would hope is that this is a place that you find someone that has earned the right to hear your story. You can share it with them and know that they are godly and wise, and they're going to walk through life with you. That is part of what it means to be a part of a church. And that's what we're here for as a staff and as church members, to do life with you. But for the first of you, I just want to lead you in a prayer. If you came here this morning, you've never made the decision to follow Jesus. You're ready to take the sin that, the way it described it in Hebrews 2, has ensnared you and pulled you away from Him. This morning is the chance to lay that at His feet, knowing this, that when you do, He forgives you, and the relationship with Him is restored. I want to lead you in that time of prayer. So if you just bow your heads for a moment. All this is to remove distractions. It's just out of respect. If you're ready to pray and accept Christ, to have a completely new trajectory for what your eternity is going to look like, I invite you to pray with me this morning. Lord Jesus, I know that I am a sinner. And I'm placing the sin that's in my life and in my heart, and I'm putting it at your feet. I recognize that my sin is what separates me from you. And I'm thankful that you've cared enough that even though I wasn't looking for you, you came after me. I'm not just accepting your forgiveness this morning. I'm accepting a new way of life. I'm asking you to come into my heart, to change me, to make me clean, and to make me new. And this morning, if you prayed that, I'm just saying every head is down, the eyes are closed. This is just a moment where we can identify you and we can help you. If you prayed that with me this morning, would you please just raise your hand? Thank you so much. Thank you. Anyone else this morning? Wonderful. Friends, I want to thank you not just for doing what is the best by showing up this morning. I want to say, you say, well, what is it that Woodridge gathers for? Why does Woodridge sing? Why do we do a sermon? And the point is always very simple, is that by the time we're leaving, we're worshiping. We're worshiping. Jesus deserves this. And that's how we're going to close. We're going to close with a song. But as a church, can we celebrate three more that have made decisions to follow Jesus today? Here's what I want you to hear. Staff, we're going to be around at the end of the service. If you made that decision, we want to begin the steps with you, to do life with you, to encourage you, to help you out, because it's only the first step. Now it's the journey on what it means to be made more and more over into the image of Jesus, and we're in that with you as well, all the way, not just to death, but beyond it, because we share an eternal hope now through Him.
We hope you have enjoyed the podcast. For more information about our church, visit www.woodridge.org.